Welcome to International Edition, our new program taking a closer look at stories of the day, social media and entertainment. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, complexities in the conflict in Iraq. Foreign policy dominating the U.S. presidential contest.
It's the state of the world right now. Republicans are seizing on the unrest around the world, on some of the difficulties that President Obama is having.
Action, reaction. What's trending on the web? And the buzz in jazz music circles about Joey Alexander. It's all ahead. President Obama has reaffirmed his support for Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi and his government's effort to retake the western provincial capital of Ramadi, which fell to Islamic State fighters on Sunday. Mr. Obama met with more than two dozen national security officials at the White House Tuesday. There was Vice President Joe Biden, Secretary of State John Kerry, the Defense Chief Ashton Carter, and General Lloyd Austin, who heads the U.S. Central Command. A National Security Council spokesman says the U.S. is looking at how best to support local ground forces in Anbar Province. Shiite militia massed Tuesday outside of Ramadi ahead of a possible offensive to try to recapture it, an operation carried out alongside Iraqi government forces who would assemble the one and the same paramilitary troops took part in last month to regain control of Tikrit. That effort halted IS momentum toward the capital, Baghdad. VOA's Victor Beatty asked RAND Corporation regional analyst Ben Connelby how problematic the introduction of the Shiite militia into the Sunni-dominated Anbar province is.
That has the potential to cause very serious problems. There were reportedly, according to open sources, Shia militia working out of the Habaniya base southeast of Ramadi, and then they moved into position on the outskirts of Ramadi to the east after the ISIS took the city. Two concerns here. First of all is the deconfliction between American airstrikes and Shia forces that might be operating in the city. That's very difficult to do in urban terrain and will likely reduce the number of airstrikes the U.S. is able to conduct if they move into the city. The second concern is that the Shia militia don't know the ground in Ramadi. It's incredibly dense and very dangerous urban terrain that the U.S. Marines had a lot of difficulty dealing with, and the Shia militia will not find it easy to fight there. And then third, of course, there is the very near history of the Shia militia activity in Tikrit after they took that city effectively by themselves with very little ISF support. And then were reported to have committed atrocities. There are a lot of Sunni who are talking about being just as afraid of the Shia militia as they are of the Islamic State.
Well, Ben, apparently this counteroffensive may kick off sooner than some would expect, given the fact that they don't want the IS militants inside the city to build up their defenses. Is that a right strategy?
Yeah, that's the smartest thing they can do. They need to move in quickly if they're going to move in. They need to ensure that they are able to penetrate deep enough in the city to obtain a foothold before the Islamic State is able to plant improvised explosive devices around the city, as they did in Tikrit and as they have done in Mosul. The improvised explosive devices really slowed down the Iraqi security forces considerably as they were moving north and took a serious toll, reportedly, on Shia militias in Tikrit.
How key will the Baghdad government's efforts to arm local Sunni tribes to join the fight be? I mean, how would you grade them up to now?
Poor. I don't think there's a lot there. Absent genuine reconciliation between the Shia-led government and the Sunni population in Iraq, there's really not much chance that you're going to have a groundswell of Sunni support for the Iraqi state where people are going to be willing to lay down their lives in large numbers, certainly as their families have been ejected from their homes and they're required to look out for them as well. You'll probably see moderate numbers of people who have little to no training probably being thrown into the fight in support of Shia militia forces, or if they're able to mass Iraqi security forces to move west, then that's the role they will probably play.
Ben, the Anbar police chief is quoted as saying that this counteroffensive will be, quote, the starting point for operations to liberate cities throughout Anbar. Is that overly ambitious?
Well, I know Qadim Faris al-Fahdawi fairly well. I interviewed him last year. He's been holding his own there in the center of the city quite bravely for some time. He deserves a lot of credit. but I do think that is an overly ambitious statement at this time. I don't see the Iraqi security forces or the Shia militia having the kind of combat power necessary to retake Anbar province anytime in the near future. Certainly the city of Fallujah, the city of Heat, various cities out west, Rutba, are all under control of the Islamic State. This is a huge territory, and it required approximately 30,000 Marines and tens of thousands of Iraqi security forces to hold down, even in the worst of times.
Ben, Iraqi troops, when they left Ramadi on Sunday, abandoned dozens of U.S. military vehicles, including tanks, armored personnel carriers, and artillery pieces. Is the fact of abandoning this hardware going to make things worse?
Yes, much worse. That's exactly how the Islamic State acquires most of its equipment. It also is a one-for-one trade-off. Clearly, the Iraqi security forces are now that much weaker because they don't have that equipment. It wasn't all that clear in the first place whether or not they were capable of using it or maintaining it, but the fact that it is now in the hands of the Islamic State is extremely troubling.
Connable says retaking Ramadi poses huge risks for Prime Minister Abadi. If he fails, it could end his administration. However, if he succeeds, it could embolden him to attempt the recapture of the northern city of Mosul, taken by IS fighters in June of last year. This is International Edition on VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I am Rick Pantaleo. Scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory have found evidence that dark material covering parts of the surface of Jupiter's moon Europa is probably sea salt produced by an ocean beneath its surface. The researchers believe the existence of sea salt on Europa's icy surface implies that its subsurface ocean is intermingling with its seafloor, something they say is a significant factor in determining if the giant moon can actually support life. But the sea salt on Europa is also discolored. Scientists said Jupiter's strong magnetic field blasts its moon with a powerful force similar to what a particle accelerator would produce. It's thought that the radiation discolored the salt, leaving it with a dark hue. A study outlining the researchers' findings has been accepted for publication in the journal Geophysical Research Letters and can be found online. And that's your Science in a Minute.
Joining me here in the studio is web desk editor Andrew Pelshevsky with a look at what's trending today. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, we have this controversy brewing in India on social media where it's playing out. You have Prime Minister Narendra Modi was visiting China and said, quote, earlier you felt ashamed of being born Indian, now you feel proud to represent the country. And this did not sit well in his home country. The hashtag Modi insults India was quickly trending, with people from across the country targeting him, people in the opposition in Congress also targeting him. The day afterwards, there was a response, hashtag Modi India's pride, everyone coming to his defense on social media. And now, just over the course of the past couple days, you have this social media battle back and forth playing out, including a letter now that's going viral of a young girl. She's Indian. She lives in Hong Kong. And she wrote this letter in support of the prime minister, and now his supporters are using that on social media. So we're sure to see more of this back and forth and play out in the coming days through these hashtags and through the tweets and everything else.
It's interesting how this flares up so quickly, you know, just boom, and then you already have a big controversy over a little side remark.
Absolutely, and this isn't the first time this has happened. I mean, there are politicians all the time and celebrities that say something, and all of a sudden it turns into a hashtag that someone's created, and that's the nice thing about social media too, is that someone can just create a hashtag like this and all of a sudden everybody jumps on it and it goes viral. Another thing actually that we're looking at that's going viral today, the Rohingya people in Southeast Asia. The hashtag Rohingya used over 100,000 times this week alone. That story is developing in Southeast Asia as those people are going to Indonesia and Malaysia, at least temporarily. So that hashtag surely is going to expand, and we may see one that comes out of this, hashtag Rohingya in Malaysia, hashtag Rohingya out, something like that. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw.
That's a very big story for that region of the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, of course, social media, because it is social and anyone can seize on it, the top trending topic this morning is on the boy band One Direction, which,
oh, really?
In the midst of all of these world stories, we have this trending topic.
And what are they saying about it?
They're on some kind of Australian Battle of the Bands show, and of course, there's so many young people using social media that they've kind of seized on this, and it's become the top trending hashtag around the world.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew. Always appreciate you stopping by.
Absolutely.
We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America.
It was announced Wednesday following a meeting between the foreign ministers of Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Wednesday that international inspectors will not be given access to his country's scientists or military sites under any nuclear deal with world powers. In Vienna, negotiators continued Wednesday working on the details of a final agreement to scale back Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. North Korea has abruptly canceled an invitation to the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to visit the state. Mr. Ban is on a five-day visit to South Korea. He said Wednesday no explanation was given for the last-minute change. And Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza is signing a decree delaying parliamentary elections until June 2nd. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Coming up on International Edition, what's dominating the U.S. presidential race? Action, reaction, what's trending on the web? And the buzz in jazz music circles about Joey Alexander. Stay tuned. Foreign policy issues are dominating the early stages of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. And national correspondent Jim Malone is here with a look at the issue. Welcome, Jim. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Susan.
Say, Americans often think of their own personal needs when it comes to the elections. You know, the economy, health care, that sort of thing. Why is foreign policy so important this time around?
It's the state of the world right now. Republicans are seizing on the unrest around the world, on some of the difficulties that President Obama is having with his foreign policy. And don't forget the top Democratic contender is Hillary Clinton, who was Barack Obama's Secretary of State. So they're going to try to pin some of these foreign policy difficulties or failures, depending on your point of view, on her.
Well, do these candidates really have any experience with foreign policy? You think of them mostly as a national issue.
A lot of them are governors. Some do have experience. For example, take Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He's going to announce soon that he's officially running. For all intents and purposes, he already is. He said the other day he's running now because the world is falling apart. Lindsey Graham is closely aligned with John McCain in the Senate, sort of a conservative voice is advocating stronger U.S. military presence around the world, ground troops if necessary in the Middle East to counter the Islamic State. So he's running specifically because of national security concerns.
Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. Does the importance of foreign policy right now, does this give her an edge up, an inside lane?
Well, the Democrats think it does. They don't think she can be attacked as inexperienced because of her tenure as Secretary of State. On the other hand, Republicans will seize what happened in Benghazi in 2012, the attacks there on the U.S. missions while she was Secretary of State. And they'll point to other problems with the Obama foreign policy. But, you know, I think for Hillary Clinton, her drive at the moment is trying to secure progressives in the Democratic Party. She doesn't want anybody on the left sneaking up on her. So her focus is making sure Democratic liberals are happy as they march toward the nomination.
Well, the economy is doing pretty good. Not great, but pretty good. Do you think this is going to be the front issue all the way to the voting?
It usually is. At the end of the day, it's how people feel about the economy, how they feel about where the country is headed. And even some Democratic pollsters, by the way, point out a lot of people aren't happy. They want some change. The trick for Hillary Clinton is going to be, I can be the agent of change even though I was part of the Obama administration. Republicans will have a different argument. They say after 8 years of President Obama, it's time for real change, and they're going to offer it. The interesting thing is, of course, on the Republican side, we don't know who's going to emerge as the nominee. It's going to be really fascinating to watch a large field battle one another for many, many months.
Well, thank you for your insight. As always, Jim, appreciate it. And come by again real soon and share your thoughts.
Always here. Happy to do it.
Thank you, Jim. That's national correspondent Jim Malone with us today. Meanwhile, President Obama doesn't have to worry about his standing in the political contest because here in the States, the president can only have 2 terms, and he's used both up. The president is off today to the Coast Guard graduation ceremonies in New London, Connecticut. He's expected to call for immediate action on climate change as the White House releases a new report on the impact of climate change on national security. According to excerpts from his speech, Mr. Obama is to say many of the nation's military installations on the coast are already being affected by rising sea levels, and droughts and wildfires could threaten military training areas in the western United States. And farther north, U.S. military facilities in Alaska are threatened by thawing permafrost. The White House says the Pentagon is studying the vulnerability of the military's more than 7,000 bases and other facilities for the effects of climate change and the possibility of increased demand on the National Guard if there's a weather disaster. The president is also expected to outline some of the ways the U.S. is making progress in changing its demands on the environment, such as increasing use of wind and solar power, increasing potential gas mileage for cars, and cutting energy waste in homes and buildings. You're listening to VOA.
Trending on the web, it's action, reaction.
Blues legend B.B. King dies at 89. Tributes from fans and celebrities coming in all over the internet. His legacy will never die, says one fan, and we agree. Bollywood superstar Salman Khan had his 5-year jail sentence suspended while he appeals a conviction for a deadly hit-and-run accident in 2002. Some are outraged, saying he shouldn't get special treatment just because he's a star. Khan's fans, though, are standing by him. We're not surprised by that. When I interviewed him in 2006, I could barely get near him.
Well, it's a lot of respect. This is a lot of love. And I'm fortunate to be in a position like this.
The Wells report says NFL Patriots quarterback Tom Brady was, quote-unquote, generally aware about the deflated footballs. Maybe he's generally aware that people out there think he's a cheater. For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Lisa Vora.
He's generating a lot of buzz in jazz music circles for his skill at the piano. His interpretations of jazz standards have earned him acclaim from the likes of Wynton Marsalis, Herbie Hancock, and other greats. VOA's David Byrd spoke with Beyond Category host Eric Felton about Joey Alexander.
The music you're listening to is not Chick Corea, it's not Herbie Hancock, it's not Harry Connick Jr. or any other jazz pianist you could name. It's Joey Alexander. Now, who is Joey Alexander, you might say? Well, he is a jazz phenom, and he's only 11 years old. His CD, My Favorite Things, is out now. VOA's Eric Felton, the host of Beyond Category, is here in the studio. Eric, where is Joey from? Where did this kid come from?
Well, Dave, it's an unlikely story. Joey Alexander's real name is Josiah Alexander Sila, and he comes from Bali, Indonesia, where his parents are in the tourism business. And his dad is an amateur piano player and had gone to school in New York City, where he collected a bunch of jazz CDs. He had those jazz CDs sitting around, and little Joey started listening to them and then started plinking things out on the piano himself, got a little help from his dad along the way. But then by the time he was 9 years old, he was playing at jam sessions in Jakarta, where Herbie Hancock took note of him and started spreading the word.
Now, this kid, you know, jam sessions is one thing, or plinking along is one thing. But this kid, he has got seasoned musicians. The bass player, you know, on his...
Larry Grenadier,
and the drummer and the trumpeter, you know, they're all saying, this kid is bringing fully formed ideas of things like Giant Steps or My Favorite Things or Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And he's leading a band of professional musicians at 11 years old.
Yeah, it is remarkable. And we're used to, in the world of jazz, phenoms and prodigies coming along on a fairly regular basis. But the thing that a lot of these phenoms have is sort of like being a young genius at math. And I think he shows that he really will have that maturity at some point. There's an artistry to his playing that's beyond just the mathematical, but that's still to come in his playing, is that kind of maturity where jazz musicians used to talk about saying something. And that was the highest compliment you could say about somebody's solo, was that they said something. And you've got to have experience of life to have something to say. That'll be the big challenge for him in the years to come.
Is all this hype about him really warranted? Do you think that we're looking at a true phenomenon here?
I think so. Maybe we can cue up and play a little bit of Giant Steps off his record. That's a tune that is the one of those things that jazz musicians cut their teeth on. Really difficult John Coltrane number. And if you can play Giant Steps, you've gotten somewhere in the world of jazz.
All right, that is VOA's Jazz TV show host Eric Felton. You can see his show Beyond Category at our website, www.voanews.com. That's also where you can post your questions or comments about anything you hear on our show. And if you want to look up Joey Alexander, you can find him on YouTube. It's J-O-E-Y and then Alexander, A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R.
That's VOA's David Byrd and Eric Felton. To learn more about Joey Alexander or other jazz musicians, be sure to catch Eric's show Beyond Category on our website. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms the murderous attack on a bus full of peaceful civilians in Karachi, Pakistan. Wednesday, May 13th was just another workday for many of the residents of Al-Azhar Gardens who rode on the pink commuter bus that morning. As the bus traveled its usual route, six men on three motorcycles pulled up alongside it and flagged it to a stop. The six men boarded the bus and immediately began to shoot the passengers. All victims were shot in the head, and at least 45 of them died. The Pakistani-based Jandallah, a Tehrik-e-Taliban splinter group that pledged its allegiance to ISIL, claimed responsibility for the murders. The vast majority of the victims were members of the Ismaili community, a branch of Shia Muslims who follow the Aga Khan as their spiritual leader. The Ismailis believe that the Aga Khan has the authority to interpret the Quran in relation to the present time. They are peaceful, progressive, and non-political. According to Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, the Ismailis are a very patriotic and peaceful people who have always worked for the well-being of Pakistan. But to extremists, anyone whose religious precepts differ even slightly from their own qualifies as a heretic. Extremists see nothing wrong with killing a human being who does not worship exactly as they do. We offer our deepest condolences to the families of the victims. The American people stand in solidarity with the people of Pakistan and with the global Ismaili community on this tragic day. Make no mistake, said Secretary of State John Kerry. There is more strength by far in the respect and solidarity that we feel towards one another than there could ever be in any terrorist attack. The United States will support efforts to bring all those responsible to justice and stands ready to provide assistance to the investigation of this tragic attack.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.